supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The state of Delaware's reputation as a haven for using limited liability companies to hide criminal activities across the globe has drawn serious scrutiny in recent months. While there are no signs of a statewide effort to change Delaware's LLC law to force companies to identify their true owners, WHYY's Chris Barish reports that the state's Department of Justice is using new powers to try to revoke the registration of one company that has run afoul of the law.
For more than a decade, Backpage.com advertised ads for prostitution and was accused of facilitating child sex trafficking. But this year, the federal government shut down the webpage, the former CEO pleaded guilty to felonies, and in Arizona, seven other executives were charged with crimes. But those actions didn't prevent Backpage.com from re-registering in June with Delaware's Division of Corporations, where it remains in, quote, good standing, as WHYY reported last week. But Attorney General Matt Den's office now says it will seek to dissolve the company. That pleases Patty D'Angelo of Zoe Ministries, which fights sex trafficking.
It definitely sends a message that trafficking is not welcomed in Delaware, and it is a great step in the right direction.
Nick Wasileski of the Delaware Coalition for Open Government commends the AG for taking some action, but he still suspects it took his research into Backpage.com status and WHYY story for the AG to act.
We are moving the ball, but don't you think that there should be some type of, I'll call it checks and balances, that they would be aware of that Backpage reform?
Still, the AG isn't going far enough for Wasileski. The AG won't take up his group's request to appoint an independent counsel that could recommend changes to the LLC law.
The Attorney General's mandate is to protect the public, and when people are laundering money and facilitating child sex trafficking, I think that falls under the definition of protecting the public. But they chose not to do it.
Delaware's 800,000 LLCs generated $274 million for the state last year. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Last week, the Pennsylvania Attorney General released a scathing grand jury report into the alleged sexual abuse of more than 1,000 children at the hands of clergy members in six of the state's eight Roman Catholic dioceses. Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski tells the story of one of those children, a former priest who was abused by a trusted spiritual leader and later got an inside view that pushed him to quit.
Like many victims of clergy sex abuse, James Feluzak grew up in a home of faith. He lived about a stone's throw away from St. George's Parish in Erie.
All of us kids in the neighborhood, we congregated there. Like, we'd play kickball or ride our bikes.
Growing up, Feluzak became more and more connected to the church, first as an altar boy, then playing guitar during Mass and working in the rectory. He says his mother was steeped in Catholic mythology. Priest to her could do no wrong, and she was thrilled when her youngest child of four started receiving extra attention from one of the parish priests, Father Daniel Martin.
There were times when all of the priests would be out of the rectory, and if he saw me on the street from the window, he would wave me in.
Feluzak says he was angry as a teen, and there were tensions between his parents at home. Martin became a trusted adult that he could turn to, and the priest already knew about his family struggles, from Feluzak's own confessions and those of his parents.
He would have me come in and sit on his lap, and he would kiss me, you know, all over the face. He was always drunk when it happened, and it would end with him saying, "Jimmy, tell me what's bothering you."
The abuse began when he was 16 years old and escalated to sexual fondling. It continued for 3 years. Even after he was molested, Feluzak's faith and bond with the church remained strong. He felt called to God and joined the seminary. He took up the cloth and spent 18 years as a priest in the Diocese of Erie. But the trauma of abuse caught up with him. He turned to drugs and alcohol and became disillusioned with the institution.
I felt like I couldn't function. I couldn't live within a system that didn't protect the most vulnerable members of the community or the most vulnerable members of the church.
Feluzak quit the priesthood in 2014. and he's one of dozens of witnesses who testified before the grand jury about their experiences of abuse. In its findings, the grand jury alleged that 301 predator priests molested, raped, or took advantage of more than 1,000 children. In the report, listed under offenders from the Diocese of Erie, is Daniel Martin. Feluzak is relieved that his voice has been heard and believed, but he says the report doesn't fully capture the feeling of trusting someone so deeply, being extremely vulnerable, and then being taken advantage of. We spoke again after the report came out.
The spiritual abuse was the worst thing of all. He manipulated my soul. You know, it's not just what he did to me physically. And I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm picturing, you know, his room and, you know, the physical motions and touch and feel of it. But what he did to me spiritually was so much worse.
Good afternoon and thank you for being here.
Erie's Bishop Lawrence Persico apologized to all victims of abuse at a press conference last week.
We have suffered in darkness for a very long time.
Back in April, Persico released a list that publicly named Martin, who died in 2006, and more than 60 others which the diocese believes have credible allegations against them.
This is a result when we spend so much time keeping things secret. For example, the whole idea of not going public with this information. That, I think, is part of our issue. And that's why it's so important that when you publicize names, people realize that they're not going to get away with it.
For Feluzak, apologies from the bishop and talks of transparency fall flat. When he was a priest, he brought several allegations of abuse and sexual misconduct to the church's attention, including his own.
Bishop Persico became bishop in 2012, and he waited 6 years to release that list. If he was all about transparency, why didn't he release the list in 2012?
To Feluzak, who remains a Catholic, deeper internal church reforms need to be made. He had an insider's view and couldn't stand what he saw.
I was happy with my assignments. I was happy with the work. The atmosphere was intolerable. Being around other priests that were creepy or leering at you, propositioning you. I can't tell you how many times I was sexually harassed. And bishops who you couldn't trust, being around all of that, it was just constant reminders to me that, okay, this is how Father Martin got away with what he did.
He now lives in Buffalo, New York. And like most victims of clergy sex abuse, Feluzak has no legal recourse. Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
Pope Francis issued a letter to Catholics today condemning the sexual abuse of children by priests as well as the cover-up of that abuse detailed in last week's grand jury report. The pontiff also echoed the increasing demand for accountability. Here to provide details on abuse prevention efforts parents should take is Angela Little, president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance. Angela, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Sure.
We'll get to the specifics of this report, but describe the work of the Support Alliance.
Well, we primarily work entirely for the prevention of child abuse. And so we have parent education and support programs statewide to help moms and dads be the best they can be. And then our primary focus is with training mandated reporters how to recognize and report child abuse. And I should say that we work with the church, including some of the Catholic dioceses, schools, and social service agencies statewide.
To the extent that you've worked with the church, were you surprised by the extensiveness and the horrors described in this report?
We actually were not. We had had enough of communication with folks to know that we were braced for it being fairly horrific. That said, when you actually read the details or when you listen to the survivors speak, it is a heart-wrenching experience.
And so that the Vatican and specifically Pope Francis responded today, that's from the top down, but it seems like your organization's efforts encourage bottom up.
Well, we encourage bottom up, but the reality is for any organization to have good, strong child protection policies and practices, to provide comprehensive training, which is absolutely needed. But we are really all about preparing folks on all levels, from top leaderships of bishops and priests to those folks who sit in the pews, who volunteer in the classes with kids and the youth activities, to really understand that everyone has a role to play in protecting kids.
How specifically do you envision enforcing transparency or openness?
I think that really does have to come from a combination of, you know, a call from the Pope, and hopefully his office being very vigilant in monitoring some of that, and then also from the people.
So the people, more specifically parents and guardians of potentially vulnerable children, what's the onus on them?
Well, I think it's been a huge wake-up call. To be fair, many parents, many guardians didn't know that they had to protect their kids. And so parents now have to realize it is a different day. They have a lot of responsibility. And it's responsibility to ask hard questions, to demand things be different. But then they've got to get in the game, too, and do a lot of monitoring.
Are you in accord with the Attorney General's recommendation to expand the state's statute of limitations?
Absolutely. I'm actually in support of all four of the grand jury's recommendations, and I think that the best first step the Catholic Church at large in Pennsylvania could do would be for each diocese to come out without equivocation, no resistance, and support all four recommendations.
Part of the transparency and accountability you're calling for includes not allowing one adult in the clergy to be with one child privately.
Absolutely, and I know that's a challenge in all religious institutions, but I think it's a different day. I think the church has to have a different construct now.
Describe the Childline.
Childline is Pennsylvania's statewide hotline for suspected child abuse cases, and it's a central registry for those folks who have perpetrated abuse. It is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We encourage folks who suspect child abuse to call that number at 1-800-932-0313. What we have to realize is the Child Protective Services system is not proactive. It's reactive. So that means the system has to be alerted to the possibility that a child is in danger or at risk and being abused. And that is the vehicle in Pennsylvania by which information can be transmitted.
To the extent that the Childline is then reactive, it seems like there's another proactive venture from your organization entitled the Front Porch Project. Explain.
Mm-hmm, correct. Well, you know, the best first step in preventing child abuse is good, strong, positive parenting. Then, you know, we have to realize not all parents provide safe environments. So then we have mandated reporters in Pennsylvania, those folks required because of their profession or volunteer role to report suspected child abuse. We hope most of the cases are caught by those folks. But sometimes families live kind of socially isolated, kids aren't involved and out about. So what we have then are the need for community members. Every community member should know how to recognize and report child abuse. The Front Porch Project provides those discussion forums to help folks learn how they can get involved when kids aren't safe.
Angela Little, thanks so much for offering perspective on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Angela Little is president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance. If money equaled votes, Carrie Evelyn Harris would have no shot at unseating three-term U.S. Senator Tom Carper in the Delaware Democratic primary next month. But as WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports, Harris is counting on her grassroots campaign message to help her overcome seemingly insurmountable odds.
Carrie Evelyn Harris couldn't be more different than Delaware's three-term U.S. senator who spent 8 years as governor after serving five terms in the U.S. House. Between January 2017 and June 2018, Carper has collected more than $2.1 million in donations. Harris, a former U.S. Air Force loadmaster, raised less than $53,000 over that time. So the Harris campaign depends heavily on volunteers.
We only have five paid staff, and when I say paid, when I'm pushing a $15 minimum wage, but we can't pay $15 minimum wage. We're really just paying our staff so that they can eat.
In addition to her support for a $15 minimum wage, Harris supports Medicare for All and universal pre-K. And while it puts her at a disadvantage, Harris is proud of her low-budget campaign.
We get 87% of our donations from in-state Delawareans who really believe in it. Our average donation is between $25 and $35.
By comparison, a quick look at Carper's campaign finance report shows contributions from myriad corporate PACs, from Walmart, Ford, and Microsoft, to Lockheed Martin, AT&T, and Bristol-Myers Squibb. And although she doesn't directly question Carper's integrity, Harris says the corporate donations give a bad perception.
The perception alone weakens our democracy. If any person feels that their vote isn't as valuable to you as the money you're getting from some corporation, then you've already lost the battle for the people. We have seen over and over and over again that corporations get to win. We see, and we're told, well, if they do well, you'll do well. But we're not feeling that. And we want it to be reversed. When we do well, as the people, corporations will do well.
She actively campaigned in New York for self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who pulled off a surprising upset over incumbent Congressman Joe Crowley in the Democratic primary in June. Harris says that upset emboldened her campaign.
We were already picking up momentum, but when she won, not only did Delaware realize that you can take on the establishment and win, you can unite communities off of messaging, they realized that now was the time.
If elected, Harris would be the first openly gay Delawarean elected to federal office, but that historic potential is not a focus of her campaign effort.
To be honest, when I decided to run, I didn't really put it together how much history would be made. I really just tried to live my life as I am and know that I should belong there.
The winner will face the winner of the Republican primary, pitting Sussex County Councilman Rob Arlett against Gene Truno, former chief compliance officer at PayPal. From the Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
WHYY is covering tonight's debate in the Delaware U.S. Senate race featuring Harris and Carper. And tune in to Morning Edition tomorrow to hear a report on that debate. The search for planets beyond our solar system is being made easier all the time, thanks to new technology and building on what preceded it. Let's go hunting with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, where are we going?
We're starting with a new survey instrument, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS is the name that's used for this, that was launched in April. And this particular survey is in our solar system, but it's looking out beyond our solar system. It's looking at this portion of our galaxy, the Milky Way, and whereas its predecessor, Kepler, looked at a very, very small section of the sky about 3,000 light years away, this one is actually looking at a much larger area. It's looking at some 200,000 stars in a hunt for more extrasolar planets.
Fishing in the ocean rather than a pond.
Yes, and in doing so, the idea is that this opens up the possibility, of course, that it could find more planets that are like our size, Earth-size planets.
Is the state of the art and science such that planets can be seen yet outside of our solar system, or is it still inferential evidence?
Well, we're really right on the cusp of being able to directly image planets orbiting other stars. Right now, it's still inferential work. This particular instrument looks for a drop in the light output from that star as an indication that something is passing in front of that star. And the most likely object that would be passing in front would be a planet. And of course, the idea is to look and see if that light drop off is periodic, happens on a regular basis, and is the same intensity, or that a pattern can be seen of how the light drops off, which could indicate that there's more than one planet.
Above and beyond the transit, though, can anything be gleaned about the atmosphere on the planet or whether there's water on the planet or little green people there?
It's really interesting that you said that because this is a survey instrument. So the intent of this is to do a much broader look at things, a broad brush look, collecting evidence that would then provide a list of candidates that deserve even closer examination. That closer examination will be done by the James Webb Space Telescope once it gets launched and it will have the ability to bring us even greater detail about some of these planets. For example, do they have atmospheres? Perhaps what kind of atmospheres do they have? Can we say anything about the possibility that they could house environments where life might develop?
So TESS will hand off to the James Webb, but TESS in turn got a lot of its information from the Gaia Project map. Explain.
Yes, indeed. The Gaia Project was a sky survey project that was conducted by the European Space Agency. It created a catalog that contains the positions, distances, motions, brightness, and colors of more than 1.3 billion stars. 1.3 billion stars. It collected all that information. It also provides the surface temperatures for about 100 million stars. You ready for that? And the effect of interstellar dust, the dimming of that light from those stars, on 87 million stars. That's a tremendous amount of data. Just a tremendous amount of data.
What percentage of the entire Milky Way does that 1.3 billion represent?
So let's look at it this way. If a galaxy seems to be comprised of somewhere between 300 billion and 400 billion stars, then we're talking about just a tiny bit over 1% maybe. So not many, but far more than we ever have been able to survey in the past. But all of the digital technologies available to Gaia allowed it to collect all of this information that has now been transferred into a catalog and also into a 3D image of the Milky Way that is absolutely stunning to see.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.